Imagine for a moment that you are stranded in the middle of a freezing, pitch black ocean.
Oh, that sounds absolutely terrifying.
Right. Like you have been treading water for hours, your limbs are going completely numb, and you are just desperately waiting for a rescue.
You're at the absolute limit of what you can handle.
Exactly. And in your mind, you have this very specific, detailed picture of what that rescue has to look like. You're expecting this massive Coast Guard cutter to just break right through the fog.
With all the bells and whistles.
Yeah, you're waiting for the blaring horns, a crew in those pristine uniforms, blinding searchlights cutting through the dark, and this massive steel deck to just hoist you up out of the chaos.
Well, I mean, that makes sense. It's a loud, triumphant, undeniable display of absolute power. When human beings feel, utterly helpless, we instinctively crave this overwhelming show of force to restore our sense of safety.
We really do.
Yeah.
But instead of the sirens and the searchlights, something entirely different happens.
Okay.
Out of the fog, this tiny, battered wooden rowboat just silently pulls up beside you.
It's a little rowboat.
Yeah, just a rowboat. And the person rowing is exhausted. They're wearing tattered clothes. And the boat itself looks like it. It might actually sink at any moment.
Wow, that is not what you were waiting for.
Not at all. And if you are conditioning your survival on the arrival of that massive steel cutter, you might actually refuse to get into that rowboat.
Just stay in the water.
Right. You might look right at your salvation and completely fail to recognize it. Which begs a very uncomfortable question for us today.
Go ahead.
Where in your own life are you currently demanding God show up as a Coast Guard cutter and you're entirely ignoring the wooden rowboat he actually sent?
That is such a powerful image. That tension between the grandiose rescues we demand and the humble, vulnerable reality of how salvation actually arrives. Well, that's the central paradox of human history.
It really is.
It completely contradicts our deeply held, almost, biological assumptions about what power and victory are supposed to look like.
And exploring that profound disconnect, well, that is our singular mission today. Welcome, beloved family members, to today's shared reflection. I am incredibly thrilled you've chosen to sit down with us.
It's wonderful to be here with all of you.
Today, our focus is squarely on a profoundly moving sermon centered on Isaiah chapter 53. Now, in many faith traditions, this text is known as the Song of the Suffering Servant.
A very famous passage.
Very famous. But our goal in this conversation is to peel back that familiar surface-level religious patina. We really want to uncover the radical, world-altering, and frankly, deeply offensive message hidden inside this text.
I like that you use the word offensive because to do this message justice, it requires a rather painful prerequisite.
Yeah.
We have to check our modern egos completely at the door.
Well, big time.
This sermon challenges us to look at the absolute darkest, most humiliating point in human history and somehow find the greatest, most brilliant light.
Which makes no sense to our normal brains.
Yeah, exactly. Conventional logic just will not help us here. We need an entirely different framework of wisdom to grasp what is unfolding in this text.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to understand the sheer power of this sermon, we have to start with the historical setup. We have to grapple with this massive historical irony.
The irony of the rejection.
Right. We have to figure out why the central figure of history, the Messiah, was violently rejected by the very people who had spent, centuries meticulously waiting for him to show up.
It's baffling on the surface.
It is. The sermon points us directly to Isaiah 53, verses 2 and 3.
Yeah.
The text states that he had no majestic appearance. No beauty to attract people to him. He was despised and rejected.
What's fascinating here is the cultural context. It's so vital. The people of that era were existing under the crushing weight of an oppressive empire.
We're Romans.
Right, the Romans. They were subjugated, they were heavily taxed, and they were really suffering. Naturally, they wanted a conquering king.
Of course they did.
They were looking for a successful and victorious deity who would descend with this overwhelming military and political force, crush their occupiers, and basically establish an earthly utopia.
So they were basically waiting for, like, a glittering superhero in a cape to fly down from the sky and save the city with lasers and explosions.
That's exactly it, a superhero.
But instead, someone shows up in dirty work clothes, quietly doing grueling, unglamorous work in the dusty trenches of their neighborhoods. And they were fundamentally offended by it.
Deeply offended.
The sermon explicitly notes that wanting this successful God You know, a god who only acts in ways that mirror a worldly definition of winning is a form of idolatry.
Yes, the idolatry of success.
But I struggle with that label a bit. Like,
well, yeah.
Why is wanting a god who wins considered idolatry? Isn't it just logical to want the most powerful being in the universe to exert that power?
Well, it seems logical until we examine human anthropology. The idolatry lies in the fact that we're projecting our own dark desires for dominance onto the divine.
Yeah.
We naturally gravitate toward power, toward visible success and control. If we can conceive of a god who is a ruthless conqueror, then our own human desire to conquer, to dominate, and to climb over others is suddenly validated.
So we want a god who essentially acts as a cosmic endorsement of our own pride.
Precisely. We construct an idol of glory without suffering.
Glory without suffering, that's a huge phrase. We are essentially reverse engineering a deity to justify our own ambitions.
That's beautifully put. And when Jesus arrived as a humble, suffering servant, it acted as a mirror, exposing all that pride. It completely shattered those idolatrous expectations.
Because it wasn't what they ordered.
Right. It proved that divine methodology operates on a completely different frequency than human ambition. The rejection of the Messiah was not some historical accident or a tragic misunderstanding.
It was inevitable.
It was the inevitable explosive collision between humanity's idol of power and God's reality of sacrificial love.
And that collision, it leads us right into the tragic irony of the cross itself. Because humanity was so blinded by their relentless desire for a shiny, victorious king, when they finally witnessed the Messiah suffering, they completely misdiagnosed why he was suffering.
They got the mechanism of the suffering entirely wrong.
Totally wrong. The sermon highlights Isaiah 53, verse 4, where the people assumed God was actively punishing Jesus for his own failures.
They looked at the physical event and judged it.
Yeah, they looked at a man being tortured by the state and deduced, well, he's in agony, therefore he must have committed a crime against heaven.
They read the spiritual reality completely backward. They assumed it was a demonstration of divine rejection, when in fact it was the ultimate demonstration of divine absorption.
Divine absorption. Which brings us to the massive theological concept the sermon unpacks, which is imputation.
A very heavy theological word.
It is. Verse 6 says, "The Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all." The sermon describes this as transferred responsibility. Now, historically, I know people use the metaphor of a massive credit card debt being paid off by a wealthy benefactor.
The financial transaction analogy?
Yeah, but honestly, that feels a bit too clean, you know, like a bit too transactional for the blood and the sheer agony described in this text.
I agree completely. Financial transactions fail to capture the biological and spiritual devastation of the human condition.
Right. So let's try looking at it through the lens of, say, a massive environmental catastrophe.
Okay. I like where this is going.
Imagine a pristine, incredibly fragile ecosystem that experiences this devastating, catastrophic industrial chemical spill.
A total disaster.
Absolute disaster. The local wildlife, the deer, the fish, the birds, they might have inadvertently triggered the spill by, like, knocking over a barrel or breaking a valve.
They caused it, but they don't understand it.
Exactly. They absolutely lack the biological capacity, the hands, the intellect to clean up a molecular hazard. They can't fix it. They are simply dying from the toxicity.
They're just trapped in the poison.
Right. So the only way to save that ecosystem is for an outside entity, someone completely uncontaminated and immune to the toxin, to step into the environment and physically absorb and extract the poison.
That is a much more accurate framework. What's fascinating here is that imputation is not merely the shuffling of financial ledgers in heaven.
It's not just moving numbers on a spreadsheet.
Exactly. It's the physical and spiritual absorption of a lethal toxicity. The Messiah steps into the contaminated ecosystem of human rebellion and literally draws the poison into himself.
But here is where my modern pragmatic brain hits a wall. And I am sure many of our beloved family members feel the exact same friction right now.
What's the friction?
Well, why couldn't humanity just clean up the spill slowly? Like, why couldn't God just set up a behavioral payment plan?
Ah, the human effort argument.
Yeah. If we do enough good deeds, if we volunteer enough, if we are incredibly kind to our neighbors, couldn't we just gradually balance the scales ourselves over a few lifetimes? Why is the debt considered so infinite that it required such a drastic, bloody measure?
It's a fair question. The answer lies in understanding the precise nature of the offense. Think about it in terms of jurisprudence. The severity of a crime is often measured by the authority of the one offended.
Okay, give me an example.
Well, if you lie to your sibling, it's a breach of trust. Maybe you get into an argument.
Sure, family drama.
But if you lie to a federal judge under oath, it is a felony that results in imprisonment. The act is the exact same lying, but the authority offended dictates the massive weight of the consequence.
Oh, I see.
Because humanity's rebellion was directed against an infinite, perfectly holy creator, the spiritual debt incurred was mathematically infinite.
So, finite creatures, meaning us using finite currency like good deeds, we simply cannot bridge an infinite gap.
We entirely lack the currency. We just don't have it.
Well,
the sermon addresses this beautifully, actually, by drawing a parallel to the ancient narrative of Abraham and Isaac in Genesis chapter 22.
Oh, right. The sacrifice on the mountain.
Yes. To understand that story, we really must view it through the lens of the ancient Near East. In that cultural context, neighboring pagan societies routinely sacrificed their children to deities like Molech to appease their wrath.
Which is horrifying to think about.
Horrifying, but it was their ultimate, desperate human attempt to pay off a divine debt. They thought they had to supply the payment. So God asks Abraham to take his son up the mountain, pushing Abraham to the absolute psychological brink.
A three-day journey of unimaginable tension. Just walking up that mountain.
Indeed. But at the very last moment, God stays Abraham's hand and provides a ram caught in the thicket.
He stops the whole thing.
He does. The profound message there was God loudly declaring to the ancient world, I am not like the pagan gods who demand the blood of your children to balance the scales. I will provide the substitute myself.
He provides the payment.
Exactly. The sermon emphasizes that just as God provided the ram for Abraham, God had to provide his own sacrifice for us. Imputation is not a cooperative effort where God does half the work and our morality covers the rest.
It's not a 50-50 split.
Not at all. It is a complete transfer of our insurmountable toxicity onto him and his perfect righteousness onto us.
Okay, let's unpack this further, because that reframes the physical event of the cross in a deeply startling way. We are so accustomed to seeing the cross as a piece of polished jewelry. Right?
We wear it on necklaces.
Yeah, it's like wearing a tiny golden electric chair around your neck.
Yeah.
It has totally lost its shock value.
It really has.
But if we strip away the diamond encrusting, the cross was a first century instrument of state-sponsored torture. It was designed to maximize public humiliation and prolong agony. Yet the sermon refers to this horrific execution as a brilliant strategic victory. It calls it a subversive power.
It is the ultimate paradox. The victory is entirely hidden in the guise of ultimate defeat.
Think about it in terms of kinetic energy. Like, in modern automotive engineering, the front of a car is designed as a crumple zone.
Okay, I follow you.
If you see a car after a massive high-speed collision, the front end is utterly obliterated. It's twisted metal. To an untrained eye, it looks like a complete engineering failure because the vehicle is destroyed.
Right. It looks like it lost the battle against the wall.
Exactly. But the automotive engineer knows that the car functioned perfectly. By deliberately absorbing and collapsing under all that devastating kinetic energy, the passenger cabin remains completely untouched.
It's such a brilliant analogy.
The deliberate destruction of the front end was the exact mechanism that saved the passenger.
Yes. Sin and divine justice are not abstract concepts. They are forces, much like kinetic energy, that cannot simply be ignored or swept under the rug by a just God. That energy has to go somewhere.
It has to hit something.
Precisely. Christ on the cross is the ultimate spiritual crumple zone. He absorbs the devastating, lethal impact of human rebellion so that humanity can walk away completely unscathed.
Man, that hits hard. But if this is a strategic victory, I have to ask about the silence.
The silence of the Lamb.
Yes. The sermon zeroes in on Isaiah 53, verse 7, where Jesus is compared to a lamb led to the slaughter, completely silent and submissive.
He didn't open his mouth.
Right. And if I am wrongly accused of something, I am shouting my innocence from the rooftops. If I am actually achieving a cosmic victory, I am announcing it.
You'd want everyone to know.
Exactly. Why did Jesus remain totally silent? Why not call down an army of angels, or at least speak up and prove the Roman guards and the religious elite wrong right then and there?
Because in our modern world, we equate silence in the face of accusation with either guilt or weakness. We believe power is demonstrated by having the last word.
By shouting down our enemies.
Right, or by returning violence for violence. But what's fascinating here is the profound nature of the lamb metaphor. It flips this entirely upside down. The silence of the Messiah was not weakness. It was absolute laser-focused obedience to the will of the Father.
So he defeated the world's power by fundamentally refusing to participate in it.
Exactly, and forgive me, but that hits the nail on the head. The subversive power the message speaks of is the revelation that true, Internal victory is achieved through sacrificial submission.
Wow.
By refusing to play by the world's rules of domination, Crass dismantled those rules entirely. As the sermon references from the book of 1 Peter, his silent suffering is the exact mechanism that allows us to die to sin and live for righteousness.
So to the world, it just looked like a miserable, quiet failure.
But in reality, the silence was the thunderous sound of the infinite debt being fully absorbed.
The silence was the sound of the debt being absorbed. That is profound. And if we actually internalize that, if we truly believe that the environmental disaster of our soul has been entirely cleaned up by an outside party without us contributing a single drop of effort,
it changes everything.
It demands a radical reorientation of how we live our daily lives. Wow. We can't just process this profound theological concept and then go about our Tuesday as usual.
No, it necessitates a complete psychological and spiritual paradigm shift. The sermon stresses that truly realizing the meaning of this message does two things simultaneously.
What are they?
First, it forces us to confront the horrifying severity of our condition, that we were so toxic, so far gone, that the very Son of God had to be crushed to fix it.
That's the painful part.
It is. But second, it simultaneously washes over us with the revelation of God's relentless, unyielding, almost incomprehensible love.
And the practical application the sermon draws from this dual realization is that we must step off the exhausting religious treadmill.
Ah, the treadmill. We are all on some version of it.
We really are. In the corporate world, we run ourselves ragged trying to prove our intrinsic worth to our managers. In relationships, we contort ourselves trying to earn the love of our partners.
And tragically, in our faith, we treat God like a divine employer.
Yes. We are constantly trying to rack up enough good deeds to ensure he doesn't, you know, fire us.
It is the modern epidemic of spiritual burnout. We are terrified that if we stop performing, we will stop being loved.
But I have to push back hard here, because this is where the theory hits the brutal reality of human nature.
Go on.
If you tell people they absolutely do not have to earn their salvation, if the toxic spill is already entirely cleaned up, human psychology dictates that people will take advantage of it.
You're worried about a license to sin?
Exactly. Doesn't this concept of subversive grace basically hand people a license to act horribly without consequence? If the debt is permanently zero, why not just go out and dump more chemicals into the ecosystem?
It is the oldest and most common critique of grace. But it fundamentally misunderstands the mechanism of human transformation. The sermon clarifies this nuance beautifully. Stepping off the treadmill is not about doing nothing.
Okay, so we're not just supposed to sit on the couch forever?
No, not at all. It is about fundamentally changing the underlying motivation for why we do anything. Let us apply your own analogy.
The fire one.
Yes. Let's imagine you are trapped in a burning building. You are unconscious and suffocating. And a firefighter breaches the wall, pulls you to safety, and in the process suffers third-degree burns over their entire body.
Well, that's intense.
When you wake up in the hospital and realize what it costs them to save you, your reaction is not, hey, great, now I can go play with matches and start more fires.
Right. Your reaction is overwhelming, life-altering gratitude.
Precisely. If you are on the religious treadmill, sweating and exhausting yourself to earn God's approval, your primary motivation is fear. It is the anxiety of, am I doing enough? What if I slip up?
It's a miserable, self-centered way to exist.
It really is. But when the reality of the cross penetrates your heart, when you realize the work is finished, that you are already fully known and entirely loved, the fear evaporates.
You don't just stop moving.
You do not stop moving. But now, your movement is fueled by an entirely different energy source. Your morality, your kindness, your sacrifices, they are no longer desperate, fear-driven attempts to earn salvation. They become a joyful, spontaneous reaction to the profound grace you have already received.
So the motivation shifts from trying to impress God to being continually moved by God.
Yes.
We transition from working for our salvation to working from a place of secured salvation.
And ironically, being completely freed from the burdensome obligation to earn love is the only psychological state that actually gives a human being the genuine capacity to love others unconditionally.
That makes so much sense.
When you no longer need people to validate your worth, because your worth is securely anchored in the suffering servant, you are finally free to serve them simply for their own good. It is absolute spiritual liberation.
Wow. Beloved family members, we have journeyed through an immense amount of territory today in our shared reflection.
We really have covered a lot of ground.
We began by confronting our own idolatrous tendencies. You know, our deep-seated desire for a flashy, successful God who only operates in victory, and how the Messiah shattered that expectation.
By showing up in a rowboat.
Exactly. We explore the devastating reality of our infinite spiritual debt and how it was completely absorbed through the miracle of imputation, not through our paltry human efforts, but through God providing his own sacrifice.
The ram in the thicket.
Right. We re-examine the cross, viewing it not as a piece of decorative jewelry, but as the ultimate spiritual crumple zone where the silent lamb conquered death through subversive submission. And finally, we unpack the liberating truth that allows us to hit the emergency stop button on the exhausting treadmill of religious performance.
It is a message that methodically dismantles the wisdom of the world, proving time and again that the deepest darkness was, in fact, the birthplace of the greatest light.
Beautifully said. As we draw our conversation to a close today, I want to leave you, our beloved family members, with a final lingering thought to wrestle with.
Something to chew on.
Yes. We have spent this time exploring the staggering dimensions of God's grace toward us. But I want you to hold a mirror up to your own life. If the infinite creator of the universe, who possesses absolute authority and power, does not demand that you exhaust yourself on a treadmill of performance to earn his love,
which we just established, he doesn't.
Right. Then why do you still demand that the people around you perform to earn yours?
Ouch. That is a hard question.
It is. How would your home change tomorrow with your spouse, your children, your aging parents, if you stopped demanding they earn your approval and instead applied this exact same subversive grace to them?
It would change everything.
It really would. Remember the wooden rowboat in the fog. Sometimes the rescue does not look at all like the triumphant spectacle we demand, but it is precisely the salvation we desperately need. Thank you for joining us for this incredibly profound exploration of the message.
It's been a real privilege.
From both of us here, we bid you a very warm, affectionate farewell. May you rest completely in the peace and the finished work of the message we just shared.